Welcome to the SICK Network Podcast, a weekly podcast discussing current and topical issues affecting SICKs across the global diaspora.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 14 of the SICK Network Podcast. I'm Mankamal Singh, and I'm joined today by fellow podcast regulars, Jas Singh and Manveer Singh Pogal. We're also joined by Dabinderjit Singh, OBE, Principal Advisor to the SICK Federation, and SICK commentator Sukhbir Singh. Waheguru Ji Ka
Khalsa.
Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh. So it's a bit of a full house today, and we're going to explore the Indian Constitution and its relationship with SICKs, and we'll talk a bit about the recently passed date, what recently was in the calendar, which was the Indian Republic Day, where in the diaspora we often see minority groups hold protests to express their relationship with the Indian state and specifics with that constitution itself. So let's kick off with Sukhbir. Sukhbir, can you give us a bit of background? You know, what is Indian Republic Day? Where does it sit within modern Sikh thought?
Yeah, I mean, so Republic Day, obviously, we just come through it this month, 26th of January. Essentially, it is the legal end to the British Raj. So the British Raj, the British Government of India Act, comes to an end and is replaced by the Indian Constitution. So it is it's in effect it's an official or legal declaration of independence. It's a bittersweet thing for Sikhs, really. And you know, if we look at it from where we are now, but it isn't just bittersweet now. It's been bittersweet for a long time, almost since its inaugural day. And there's lots of reasons for that. I think it's important as well for people to understand. I think what was interesting was the discussion around Sikhs protesting Republic Day, and the commentary and the sort of the perception that I suppose most people would take from that in some way Sikhs are anti-Indian or anti-Republic Day, or we have a real problem with Republic Day itself. And I think that impression, when you look at the kind of the historical background of the Sikh contribution to Republic Day, because at the end of the day, Republic Day is the legal declaration of independence of India, but it wouldn't have come about without independence being achieved. And independence was achieved at great cost. And I think it's interesting to me, it's incredible to me sometimes when we talk about this, because I talk to a lot of non-Sikh people. I talk to Indians, if you will, and other British Asians who aren't from a Sikh background. And sometimes it's almost difficult to express the level of Sikh contribution without thinking that those people think that you're exaggerating, or that the statistics are made up, or somehow it's just impossible, because it seems... It does actually seem, when you look at the numbers, it's extraordinary. I mean, it's mind-blowingly extraordinary.
The contribution, the Sikh contribution to the independence.
The Sikh contributions to achieving independence. Mm-hmm. So these figures, I'm not going to go through all of them, but just a couple, just as an example. So, the Prime Minister of India, Abdul Kalam Azad. He played a quite large part in the ceremony that took place when Shastra connected Guru Gobind Singh Ji were returned from Britain to India in the 1960s. And this was the first, as far as I can tell at least, this is the first time that these statistics were quoted, and they were quoted by him, and they were quoted from British records. And those figures were as follows. So of 2,175 people who died, so when they say died, these are people that would have died whilst in incarceration, perhaps in other ways where they were subject to torture or some of the ill kind of abuse, but people who were essentially agitating for independence. Of the 2,175 that died, 75% were Sikh. Of the 2,646 who were imprisoned for life or sent to the Andaman Islands for lifetime exile, and the Andaman Islands are just a group of small islands off the coast of India, which are uninhabited. It's like being dropped in the middle of just a wilderness, essentially. And of course, that would lead to a very early death and quite a horrible one at that. So 2,646 of those people, 80% of those were Sikh. Of the 172 who were officially sent to the gallows, so hung, 92 of those were Sikh, or 80%. So again, the difficulty is when you talk about these things, you're literally saying to somebody, out of, say, each 100 people who gave their lives for agitating for independence for India, out of each 100, statistically, less than just over one was Sikh. But in terms of the sacrifices made, between 80 and 90 of those people were Sikh. So you start to see the level of sacrifice on the part of the Sikhs in order to achieve independence for India. And the difficulty is, after that level of sacrifice, that level of contribution, it was very clear very, very early after India achieved independence that their position was not going to be the position that they had either felt for themselves, or the position that they felt that they deserved and which had been promised to them. I think the other point quickly to make as well is that India as a concept wasn't really in the minds of those people, in many cases, the minds of the people who were, as an example, involved in the Gadar movement. When you look at the letters, you look at the back and forth correspondence between members of the Gadar movement, they talk exclusively about Punjab because that's what they understand. There was no concept of India because, in truth, there has never been an Indian national state. It's never existed. So the people that were willing to fight, die, give their life, sacrifice, were essentially fighting, in their minds at least, for a Punjab. Now, because of the Sikh psyche, the idea of this being a collective and a collective effort and a collective outcome is very much entwined within Sikh thought. So the idea that the Sikhs were doing this and that would give freedom, not just to them in Punjab, but to the whole of India and all of the and all people who regarded themselves as being of the subcontinent, so whether they're Muslims or Sikhs or Hindus, that was very much part and parcel of what they felt was the right thing to do. So again, you start to understand, if you can pick just that little part of history there and then look at the subsequent even 10 years after that event and what happened to the Sikhs, then you start to understand where the animosity towards the Republic Day itself comes from, and also the animosity within the Sikh community, really, with regards to what India was meant to be, what it should have been, and also, as we can see in bringing it right up to today, what India actually is compared to what it was meant to be, which was a union of independent, sovereign, republic, autonomous units with residuary powers, which would protect and safeguard minorities. It was a collective idea, and this is, of course, that's where the issue occurs, and that's what we're dealing with at the moment.
Raji, I'm just going to interject there. Is it too much of a stretch for me to say that the concept of a united India or a nation of India doesn't actually originate from India itself?
It doesn't. You're absolutely right. It's a colonial construct.
Yeah, and it comes from the concept of removing the imperial power. It actually comes from slave trade and exchange of thoughts over in the United States, which then get taken back home, which then kind of manifests itself in various African states removing the imperial power. And that flushes its way through to this collection of states that we now call India itself. Is that correct?
Yep. Absolutely. I mean, if you think of it in an even slightly more broader way, why was India ever subjected to colonialism in the first place? I mean, colonialism, the justification of colonialism is racism. Yeah. Ultimately, we had to have, or the British had to have, and all colonial nations had to have some kind of backstory as to why it was okay to go to somebody else's land, take their land, take their resources, turn those people into slaves, and essentially rule over them. And the justification was, in the very early stages, was one of civilizing, pacification, you know, turning what were pagans and savages into civilized people. Religion was kind of the vehicle for that through kind of a missionary type of movement. But you know, in terms of selling it, I suppose, to the British public, because you have to remember as well, regardless of what the powers that be. So the East India Company at the time, of course, was kind of the, you know, they made the beachhead into India. And they were an entirely commercial venture at that point originally. And as they made inroads in and they started to, you know, take over more and more territory, it became apparent to the crown, the monarchy as it was, the British state, that this was something that they could get involved with and be part of. So it's something which people, I guess, always seem to justify by saying, well, it was of its time and this is how it was and that's how things are. But that's not really, in actual fact, the truth. It still had to be sold to the people. So selling it to them was, again, was the idea that they were doing good. And even to this day, and what I found incredible really was I saw a statistic somewhere that 40% of people even to this day believe that the British Empire was a force for good. And even more surprisingly, I think that's the opinion of most, or if not all, of the current ethnic minority ministers that we have in the cabinet, right? that you know, that it was a force for good, which I think is a very difficult argument to make.
So I mean, that's really interesting, right? When you look at the historical context and the differentiation between independence when that was announced, obviously come with that comes partition of Punjab, and we'll touch on that as we go through, because that's a very critical time for Sikhs and the split of the Sikh kingdom, which was an absolute designated territory with treaties of its own. And when we talk about Sikh Raj and Sikh kingdom, and Sikh rule, then it stems back from that. But as you've mentioned, the Republic Day is where it's constitutionally recognized. Obviously, at this point, we've got to talk about the constitution itself. And Dabindji, you probably seen this aspect, because Sikhs and people see that Sikhs are objecting to whether it's Republic Day or Independence Day, and that's a post 1984 era. Well, actually, Sikhs at the time opposed the constitution and actually never signed up to the constitution. But you need to talk us through what were the specifics of the constitution, what it said and what it referred to, and why was it such an objection for Sikhs that time in his drafting up until today?
I think everything that we mentioned is relevant to this, because the constitution didn't just happen on the 26th of January 1950. And that's the other thing, 1950. Independence happens in 47, but it takes them to 1950 to declare their own constitution, the Republic of India. But actually, I was reading up about this. You can trace the Indian constitution back to 1928. Meeting took place in Lucknow. So it took them 22 years to really formulate the constitution. And what actually happened in 1947 was they constituted a group of people. I think they called it the Constituent Assembly. And Hakam Singh, Sardar Hakam Singh, was the Sikh representative. And I'm going to quote from Hakam Singh as to what he said about the constitution and why he said it. So Hakam Singh said, "Let it not be misunderstood that the Sikh community has agreed to this constitution. I wish to record an emphatic protest here. The minorities, and particularly the Sikhs, have been ignored and completely neglected." Now, why did he say that? Why he said that was Article 25B of the Indian Constitution effectively labels Sikhs as Hindus and forces Sikhs to follow the Hindu Marriage Act, the Succession Act, the Minorities and Guardianship Act, and various other pieces of legislation. Now, you could argue this was a very clever way, after all those sacrifices that Saqib mentioned, that in 1950, the powers that be used a constitutional mechanism to try and destroy what I would say the autonomy and the sovereignty of Sikhs in one sentence. Now, the reason why it's worth focusing on the constitution is the constitution has part three is about fundamental rights. That covers articles 12 to 35, which article 25 is in the middle. But actually, there's loads of other articles in those fundamental freedoms that we have to touch upon because it's not just article 25. But the key to this is when we talk about independence movements, in India, they talked about these fundamental rights actually in 1895. There was something called the Constitution of India Bill of 1895. So not only did it take them 22 years since they convened that meeting, but there was a bill that talked about these freedoms. And it was all done because there was a growth in nationalism and the need for self-rule or independence. So it goes back to 1895. So actually, when we talk about Sikh independence, which is naturally that talk, we need to put some of these figures into context. This is how long India was talking about this constitution. Then they didn't even have it for 1947. But the key to this is Article 25 and Hukm Singh. So it's absolutely the case that Sikhs have never agreed to the Indian constitution, and it's been 73 years. And another fact I picked up is there's been 105 amendments to the Indian constitution. The last one was on the 15th of August, 2021. So if the powers that be have recognized from day one, Sikhs do not accept they are Kesavadi Hindus, as we say, then why haven't successive Indian governments or politicians changed that constitution? Because in a way, they've tried to destroy our autonomy and sovereignty in the constitution. And they could have made that amendment because Sikhs of all political persuasion have burnt the constitution from Badal to Simran Singh Mann, etc., to Captain Amrinder. And because it's very difficult for any Sikh, it doesn't matter what label you give them, to accept they are Hindus, because that's what the constitution says. So I'm going to stop there, but I do want to come back to the fundamental rights because, you know, there are things like the right to life, you know, religious freedoms, the right to a speedy trial. These are all things that live out daily for people like Jaggi. You know, when you have the death penalty and you don't get speedy trials, and we could talk about hundreds of Sikh political prisoners, because the reality is for Sikhs, the constitution isn't what the paper is written. But actually, it goes further. The constitution means nothing if you have a corrupt legislative system and a failing judicial system, because you can have all these rights on paper. And the Indian constitution supposedly is the longest ever constitution. They studied 80 different other constitutions. But the point is, that's not the daily experience of, I'm not talking about Sikhs now, I'm talking of people that live in India. You know, religious bigotry is probably at a peak at the moment. So if you start going to, you know, freedom of speech, you know, we just had the Modi BBC saga. You know, they react in a particular way that they don't want freedom of speech, they don't want freedom of expression. They don't want the people of India to learn that people across the globe hold certain views and looked into their current prime minister. So I think, you know, if you start to undo the constitution and the history of it, I just remembered one other thing. Article 1 of the Indian constitution basically refers to a union of states. And I think this is the biggest challenge for India, that union of states gives a certain amount of autonomy to states, but actually the practice is central government has been taking those rights away. And the biggest one was Article, I think it was 370, which basically took the rights away from Jammu and Kashmir. And that was a massive thing. They just did away with that article of the Constitution because it suited them to take power from the centre. And this has happened to Punjab in the past, Governor Rule. So the point is, the Constitution for Sikhs isn't the worst paper it's written on. But more broadly, I don't think it's a constitution that actually helps ordinary people living in India, because whether they be religious minorities or whether they be people who want a fair trial, you know, the whole system is corrupt, and therefore the constitution doesn't actually mean anything to them.
So, Bhaji, you know, we talked about 1950 and the change that the constitution brought towards the autonomy of Sikhs. I mean, are we able to talk about what precursors to the constitution, actually how Sikhs fitted in those pre documents or those pre constitutions that existed prior to the Indian Constitution of 1950? I know the Ananda Marriage Act was one of them. Was there more than that?
And I think this is the dilemma, that in that period of British rule, we know the British were clever enough to use Sikhs and sacrifice Sikh lives for their interests. And in return, there were probably things that the British did, which was to recognise Sikhs and recognise that separate identity. But actually, I think it was Master Tara Singh who said something along the lines of, all that's happened to the Sikhs is that the white rulers changed colour. You know, these people have come along, but I think in some ways, they've been worse. What the British did was quite open, you know. So if you had, you know, Sikhs being beaten, killed, etc., that's for everyone to see. But the way the politicians that took control after 1947 dealt with the Sikhs, this was probably the first major thing about the constitution. I think prior to that, you know, if you think about it, the British said there were three groupings. There was the Indian Congress, Muslim League, and effectively the Sikhs and the Akali Dal. So the British, in a way, recognised that Sikhs were much more important than the numbers, because they had them around the table. But obviously, the decisions that Sikh leadership made at the time, you know, won't go into that. That's probably more of an independence discussion. But I think the constitution will always be a thorn in the side of whoever runs India, because Sikhs can never accept they are Hindus. It's as simple as that. There are some people that say, oh, you don't understand the Indian constitution. Actually, they use that to give you rights to wear the kirpan. It goes as far as that. You know, they completely missed the point.
I just wanted to touch on that point, actually. In respect of what it actually is, I find the Constitution really confusing to read, and it's confusing in many different places. We've touched on this aspect of saying that, and I quote from it, Hindus are construed as including people professing the Sikh, Jain, or Buddhist religions, and Hindu institutions shall be construed accordingly. It then goes on to say, people of the Sikh faith wearing and carrying the kirpan shall be considered as included for the profession of the Sikh religion. If you interpret this one way or the other, it is also saying then that if Sikhs are Hindus and vice versa, that any one of these four faiths included, banded in this, could carry a kirpan. There is so many vagaries within the constitution of India. Most legal professionals would look at it and find so many holes within it. I mean, we have this, I mean, looking at it in comparison, right? We've just had a referendum a couple of years ago on Scottish independence away from the United Kingdom. It states within the Constitution of India that once a state is signed to it, it cannot leave it. There is no mechanism in which to leave it. There's no democratic instrument that can be applied that would facilitate even a democratic discussion about leaving the constitution of India. That in itself is quite perverse and restrictive.
Just going back though, Manveer, to what you said, I think I'm thinking of the layperson's understanding of the constitution. Mm. I think Supreme Court have looked at this, and what they really said is at the time of the constitution, those that were clearly drafting it were thinking of the main religions were Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity.
Yeah.
And as far as they were concerned, the rest were all Hindus. So they weren't even considered.
Yeah.
Yes, they're in and they're mentioned, and that's what the interpretation of Article 25B is. It's very clear that as far as constitutionally concerned, you know, that's why the Hindu Marriage Act, you know, is there. It can't be more blunter than that, that, you know, if you get married in India and you have an undercarriage, you still have to then wander off somewhere and get a Hindu Marriage Act certificate. So talk about our parents that were probably born in India and probably got married in India. They've got this certificate which says Hindu Marriage Act, which is just, you know, ridiculous in this day and age.
Hmm.
So from post 1947, then as we started as these things started emerging, we started seeing our first set of prisoners. Sukhbir touched on the prisoners of pre 47 and for the fight for independence, but that carried on within the Sikh political activism, because from the outset, Sukhbir, we started seeing the likes of Master Tara Singh and other Akalis being imprisoned very early on.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's something that the three representatives in themselves, so Jinnah went on to become the Prime Minister of Pakistan and Nehru the Prime Minister of India, but within a very short period of time, Master Tara Singh, representative of the Sikhs, found himself as a political prisoner. And this was a beginning of something which more or less every 3 or 4 years, there was some reason for Sikhs to agitate. And again, the way that the Indian, the Indian polity kind of tries to frame this is that the Sikhs are quite uppity. They agitate for no reason. In fact, they agitate because they have no choice. They found themselves essentially trapped in a very unfair contract, which they hadn't expected. They took a lot for granted. They can be blamed for naivety. I think that's a fair thing to say. But they also had trust, and they believed that they would be. Just very, very, very quickly on the sacrifice. So, Jazz mentioned the partition of India. The partition of India, which was essentially the vivisection of Punjab, that left 40% of the Sikh community homeless. That's nearly half the community left homeless. The best lands, nearly 80% of the best irrigated, most fertile agricultural lands were left in West Punjab, which then obviously became Pakistan. So the Sikhs effectively not just sacrificed their own selves in terms of themselves in, you know, individuals, they sacrificed their own sovereignty in a sense in order to create sovereignty for other people. So what we end up with just a few decades later includes Bangladesh. We have a home for the Bangladesh community. We have the Pakistan. We have an Indian or Hindustan. And the people who gave the most to create each one of those nation states are the only ones that don't have one themselves. So effectively, we became tenants after making homes for other people. I mean, when you think of it in that way, I think everything else starts to make more sense. But you're right, the political prisoner situation started with Master Tara Singh. Then we have, of course, we have agitation, which comes later for Punjabi Subha, which again is very much around Punjabi identity, Punjabi language. There is a reorganization of states on a lingual basis, which is granted to other states as a matter of course. Comes to Punjab, not so much, not easy. In fact, something that was very, very deliberately opposed by Nehru, and also opposed by what were then the kind of the early green shoots of very right-wing supremacist Hindu groups. So was the Arya Samaj as an example. I mean, it's again, it's a sad fact of history that the Sikhs are cast in terms of the narrative for most Indians, and that's the sad part, really, because I truly believe if most Indians really sort of had the had a factual history of the Sikh experience, they would not hold the opinions and the views that they do. But they do for a reason, because at the end of the day, we do not control that narrative. But the Arya Samaj were the people who, at that point, when the state was being reorganized along linguistic lines, they were the ones who went house to house to speak to Hindu Punjabi families and ask them and say to them, look, they're going to bring Punjabi in as the state language, and this essentially is a threat to you. The fact you speak Punjabi, and you've always spoke Punjabi, and your father and your grandfather and his grandfather and so on and so forth, that's got nothing to do with it. This is about you. And you must align yourself outside of Punjab. So you must remove your Punjabi identity and align yourself with the larger Hindu community. So Hindi must be the language that you say that you speak. And of course, you know, this was an absurdity. So you had situations where people, the people who were doing the survey would knock on somebody's door and say, you know, what language do you speak? And very chaste Punjabi, they would say, you know, they won't say Hamari Boli Hindi, they say Meri Boli Hindi. You know, they're speaking Punjabi to describe the language that they're speaking. But that was the sawing of the dragon's teeth. That was the beginning of it. That was where we started, because obviously, so the Punjab, you know, it's a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state. The division's already been made with the Muslims. So the Punjabi Muslims, suddenly the partition comes, they become Pakistani. We're left with Punjabi Hindus and Punjabi Sikhs. And then the division comes again. And this time the division is to divide Sikhs from Hindus and have Hindus to look outside of Punjab rather than consider themselves Punjabi. So in many ways, you know, the partition of, the independence of India, in a sense, was the death knell of Punjab. You know,
that's a really key point that I think those who sort of follow the Sikh history will know and know well, but the wider Punjabi population may not fully grasp. I mean, when you talk about the contributions to independence, that's one thing, and that's massive and it's significant, especially when you look at we made up less than 2% of the population, even now, and it was probably less then. But if you think about how Punjabis react, and that whole narrative to demonize Sikhs, not only is Punjab split in two, it is then split further into three thirds. And one third is left of Punjab and Haryana and Himachal Pradesh is created, as you said, on linguistics, where they were encouraged and even forced to declare Hindi as their mother tongue as opposed to Punjabi. And that dilution of Punjab was all strategic and all tactical to keep the Sikhs weak and to have an inroad into its natural resources, which was the water rivers and the fertile lands. But this something that happened nearly 70 years ago. Actually, I think with many people, the penny only dropped 2 years ago with the farmers' protest, because essentially that was the modern day dilution of Punjab by the central government. And if you put all of the Sikh agitations to one side, whether it was the Anandpur Sahib resolution 1984, the declaration of Khalistan from the Sarbat Khalsa in 86, the Sikh struggle, the prisoners, the all the campaigns that Sikhs have led on a Dharmic perspective, actually all of those roots go back to saving Punjab, in an essence. That these were all born out of the attack on Punjab itself, and Punjabis and Sikhs primarily. That the farmers' protest and the three farm laws was another strand to that, but the reaction was different to every other agitation Sikhs have faced. And I think that's the one parallel that I wanted to get your view on, in that the awakening in ordinary Punjabi, because the state's done a fantastic job of demonizing any Sikh struggle, that it's separatist, it's extremist, it's terrorism. But actually, when the way you outlined how Sikhs have been treated, and even what Vinodji Paji said, even going back way before the constitution it was even formalized, that this was always their intent. There's a quite a powerful message here that many Punjabi Sikhs just failed to grasp or failed to, or refused to accept.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult thing. I think people don't want to accept it. I think that, you know, a really big part of it is that people, and the other thing which is interesting is the consistency. So of course now we're in a period since 2014 where we've got a very right-wing Hindu supremacist government, and people, you know, think, okay, so that's what India is now, but that's not really India. But if you look at what's happened, it doesn't matter which party was in power, whether it was the Congress or the Janata Party or now the BJP, the consistency in which Punjab has been treated is absolute. There's almost no break in the consistent ways of trying to subjugate, weaken. And when you start to understand why that's the case, then it all starts to make sense. So what we have now is a very explicit attempt to create an ethno-religious state. That's what the BJP talks about. It talks about it very openly. That's essentially creating a Hindu Rashtra. So when we start to think about that, that that's really what the end game was and always really was, because again, it doesn't have to be expressed, but actions speak louder than words, and the consistent actions of consecutive Indian governments have all moved in the same direction. When you start to understand that, then you start to understand all of the component parts of that, one of which is, for the Sikhs at least, the part of the identity, I mean, where you, your language is a very significant component of your identity. And of course, the attacks on Punjab started very early. They haven't gone away. They're still there. They're consistently there. The attack on religious independence or the uniqueness of Sikhs, again, is there. Because if you're trying to create an ethno-religious state where basically Hindustan, then there's only two ways you can go. Those which can't ever fit within that description, they must be separated and either accept that they are second-class citizens within the state or they leave the state and go elsewhere. Then you have the other groups which you feel that you can absorb. So this is essentially what is going on and what's been going on for a long time. The farmers' protest, and again, it's a very good example of people coming together and perhaps understanding really for the first time, maybe a lot of Sikhs who describe themselves as moderate. I mean, I personally hate the description of moderate and extremist. It actually makes no sense. It's very reductive, and it actually plays into the hands of the people who come up with the terminology in the first place. But those people who would regard themselves as being relatively kind of pro-India or happy, you know, happy to be part of India, for the first time, I think those people started to consider, why are these farmers being subjected to the treatment that they're being subjected to? Why is this happening to them? And it was almost impossible. In fact, it is impossible to look at how the Indian state dealt with the farmers' protest without actually seeing that these people are not being treated as normal Indian citizens. Their ethnicity, their background, their identity is having a direct effect on the way that the state is dealing with them. And that was eye-opening for a lot of people.
Well, I'm going to just interject there. I also, maybe it's anecdotal in its nature, but when these censuses were taking place, I'm also informed that Punjabi households were also encouraged to state that the second language was Tamil, quite bizarrely, just to reinforce the fact that Punjabi was not a language spoken at all, despite the fact that they were speaking and responding in Punjabi also. So even on a second language,
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that may well be the case on that. But I think also, you know, the way the whole framing of the farmers' protest and, you know, how it was a different awakening, I think it's always about timing. And I think you can't have had the farmers' protest if you hadn't had 84. You can't have had 84 if you hadn't had the history pre to that. So all this sort of chronology of everything that happens, I think, just leads to the next.
They all intersect. Podcast.
Yeah, intersects.
I think very clearly, as far as the Indian state is concerned, there are three components to which are most important in terms of breaking the Sikhs down, if you want to put it that way. One is obviously language. So to break them from their language, but also the identity of Punjab. So you see a lot of cultural appropriation going on. It's been going on for a long time, since the 90s, in a really, really big way. And the idea, again, is to remove that association that Sikhs have with Punjab, because in a sense, your identity is tied also to where you identify yourself as coming from. And why we may regard ourselves as Punjabi rather than Indian, this grates. So you break the identity with the region, and then you take away the language. The other issue, as far as the Indian state is concerned, is the Guru Granth, Guru Panth situation, which, of course, is the kind of bedrock of Sikhism. That is a really big issue. And again, we've seen consistently the attacks on Guru Granth Sahib, either in a kind of a doctrinal way from 47 forwards, and in today's world in a very literal way, physical attacks. And again, the point of all of this is twofold. One, to try, and of course, Derabad, which is the promotion of these kind of fake holy saints men, who again, largely their purpose is to break people who perhaps aren't as well informed, aren't as well educated really with regards to their Sikhi for whatever reason, to take them in a different direction and move them away towards, in their mind, a living guru, as in a human being who can be then kind of manipulated, exploited, and whatever else. So again, it's about causing divisions. Each and every component part of this is about breaking down the Sikhs. So,
if you think about that, and what the point that you, Manpreet and Mankamal mentioned on that, if you wouldn't have had these issues had it not been for the setup before, but all of that comes from Sikh history itself, from our guru's times. If you think about everything that happened for a specific reason, and it set an example and a lesson for us to learn. And I think the point of having these podcasts and these discussions is really for us to explore, and what is the real lesson? What is the learning from what we've been through, and what do we want others to look into, research for themselves, awaken for themselves, because Punjab is a melting pot and it's always a struggle. No matter what year it is, no matter what month, there's always a struggle going on in Punjab, and it's what we live for. But a lot of this stems back from the British involvement, because obviously a lot of people look and focus on Sikhs are campaigning for their freedom. They're campaigning for their rights. But this isn't nothing new. This is what we've lost. It's not what we were hoping to gain. Pakistan was created out of 1947. It didn't exist before. We had a kingdom before, and the Brits knew we had a kingdom before. And that was annexed. There was treaties in place that identified that, recognized that. And I think it's relevant because we now have a repeat, or certainly a significant influence of the Anglo-Indian relationship concerning the Sikhs. And we put, I think, when you mentioned Juggi, and we've seen that play out in our eyes of how the British establishment will act when it comes to India, even for one of its own citizens who happens to be Sikh. So what's your sort of view on that three-way relationship and how it's been exploited, and how both of used the Sikh community and sort of misused for their own gain and their own advantage, and are still continuing to do so?
What I was going to say is that all five of us, I think, are British-born Sikhs. And it's only at times when you reflect in these podcasts, you think about how India has got Britain in a position whereby it can use the history to silence them. So that colonial past and what they did, they used to their advantage by saying, hands off, don't say anything about it, don't criticize us. And yet, privately, everyone knows what the BJP and Modi, etc., stand for. And what's worse for the Sikhs is we're portrayed by the Indian authorities in a particular way, in a negative way, that the Brits just buy into for the same reason. Yet if you stood back from it, you would say those in power in Britain shouldn't be lecturing to Sikhs, given what we've been through and the way they've used and abused us. Actually, that same colonial past is more relevant to Sikhs. And yet, we get targeted even now in 2023. And so I just think, you know, the reason to talk about the Constitution and the significance of it is this has been an historic problem. It goes back to, you know, like I said, 1895, when they were talking about, you know, if we were in 1895, it was the Indians that were demanding their independence. It was the growth of nationalism, you know, and it took them a long time to get that independence and get that constitution. And as we said, you know, with the lives of Sikhs being sacrificed in huge numbers. And I was just thinking when we did the Sacrificing Sikhs podcast around 1984 and what followed, actually, that concept of sacrificing Sikhs has been there almost from day one. We become sacrificial lambs for whoever the powers are, whether it be the Brits, whether it be the Indians, or whether it be both of them. And I think, you know, if we were thinking about, you know, an independent public inquiry around 1984, actually, the thing that's never been done is around when India and Pakistan were created, partition, the way the Brits got out so quickly, all those that lost their lives, you know, of all faiths or no faith, you know, that's a huge scandal. Yeah. And I think the more we tell that story to ordinary Brits through things like the podcast or whatever, actually, those in power today in Britain should actually say, deep down, actually, the Sikhs were there in our time of need. And yet, when we're being, effectively, you know, being through a genocide, we are still targeted. People like Jinnah are still. And then.
So look, I mean, the key question comes here then, is it in us, is it a complex that we have? That if we look at through the ages then, you had the Mughal Raj, which was very violent and horrific, but lasted 1,000+ years. But the gurus at the time challenged it and continued to challenge it. And then you had the British Raj for circa 200 years. And I'm not sure whether it's just we don't have that version from history that there would have been sects at that time that would have been supportive of the state and calling the actions of the our gurus and Banda Singh Bahadur and others after that as extreme. Why are you going against the state? Why are you calling out? Let's just live in harmony and peace. We certainly had them in the British era, and we have the same view today. It's probably been growing, and I don't know that, but in terms of where we look at with the Indian state, there is this mentality that yes, India, everything India is great, we need to coexist, and they have turned not a blind eye but both blind eyes to the injustices that have happened. And I think we've articulated it fairly openly, and I don't think we've taken a biased view. It's actually quite a factual view that Sukhbir has shared some of the data, and all of this is readily available. But why is it that we still have this complex that we won't, many Indians and Punjabi Sikhs won't challenge the Indian state or refuse to, or do not see the discrimination? And it's so obvious, and this year, even last year, and I think for the last 3 years, even the hardened pro-India thinkers can't explain why Punjab, the Punjab regiment, the Sikh regiment, is excluded from their Republic Day ceremonies and celebrations. And it's like they just seem to be blind to that they will. They're just brainwashed on it.
Just looking at that, I mean, look, I always I'm quite sensitive about riparian rights, given that the world operates on the basis that if water originates or goes through your land, then you have a right to it. It's a federal system. And as Bhaji, Sukhbir Bhaji mentioned at the start, it was about accommodating different kingdoms as one, and for those rights of minorities to be maintained. Punjab loses $191 billion by giving free water to Rajasthan and Haryana. To put it into perspective, that's 14.93 lakh crore rupees. This is more than double the entire GDP of Punjab. This equals 4.98 lakh per person each year. To put that into further perspective, by the official data, Punjab shares 8.6 MAF, a measurement of water, with Rajasthan, and 3.5 MAF of water with Haryana. This totals 12.1 MAF of water going out of Punjab. What does math mean, MAF? It means how much water is needed to raise the water level in a million acre field by 1 foot. How many liters are there in one MAF? There are 14,925 billion liters, or 14.992 lakh crore liters in just one MAF.
So that's, I mean, it's clear, Manveer. I mean, the stats you're putting out there, it's shocking. And I think...
Just to interject there, we know water's not free and sells for a cost. When we go to the market, a bottle of water sells for around 20 rupees a litre. Let's assume that Punjab sells water for only 1 rupee a litre. That would mean revenue of said $191 billion. The total GDP is around 6 lakh crore, and the $191 billion equates to 14.92 lakh crore. Revenue from Punjab's waters would triple the GDP of Punjab.
I think that's clear.
On a social level, yeah. You know, the debt that's there in Punjab at the moment that links to all these issues around farmer suicide. Income for Punjab as a whole would triple, right? Average each resident would have an annual income of 6.98 lakh. Total debt on Punjab is 3 lakh crore. It would be paid off in less than 3 months' revenue from water sales at a 20th of the market price. GDP of Punjab would then be close to 10% of the GDP of India. No other state in India shares its natural resource for free. Punjab pays to import coal from Bihar and Jharkhand. Punjab pays to import marble and natural gas from Rajasthan. Instead of appreciating the free water shared by Punjab, all we get is dehumanization from the Indian state that reports on the state of the sex.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's very clear stats. When we use the first time, probably I've seen it being put into that sort of concise manner. But I think we have to come to a point now where we need to summarize this podcast and this conversation. I mean, we've opened conversations and we've probably not closed any. And no doubt this is going to be one of those one of those issues that will carry on forever. I mean, is there, I think, but Jazz, you touched on that and you said that basically, you know, why have we bought in, why has the majority or such a significant number just bought into this and so numb and unaffected by everything that we've just talked about and so blindly accept a place in India? And I think that's the challenge and that's the difficulty we have. I mean, are we looking at changes to the constitution? Are we looking at, changes to the state? Or are we just looking at independence and sovereignty? And that's what's the discussion and that's what's been rising over the last few decades.
But I think Max, thanks. That's what you said at the start is where we should leave it, is that we've opened a lot of questions, probably not closed them all, but that's for the listeners to go and find out. Because I think as many of our followers is they're so tuned into one view. Somebody telling you an opposing view, it's just difficult for them to accept. And we see this day in, day out. But I think if we leave enough questions out there, and I think you've heard enough from Sir Kabir, from Dabindajit, from Manveer, that anyone who really opens their eyes and looks into this, and certainly younger generation, go and ask your parents. Ask, have the conversation. I think Partition, 47, the 60s, the Punjabi Subah movement, 1984, all of these critical historical events and movements have just been shoved under the carpet in our history, which has probably led to that very blinkered view of India, because we've never really debated and discussed the trauma that has been suffered by a community. And that has to flow, and that has to flow naturally. That has to be questioned, that has to be explored. And I think only then that hopefully Sikhs will open their eyes to the reality of what we're living in, which is a glummy, a psychological enslaved situation in Punjab.
I think that this is probably the best place to close it, because I think, unless Dabindajit or Sukhbir want to add anything to that.
Could I have a slightly different perspective? Because all the things Chow said are relevant, that, you know, we can, hopefully people listening to this podcast have learned something about the constitution and everything that happened before and after. But actually, in terms of why do Sikhs end up being used, you know, throughout history? And I think it goes back to actually when Guru Gobind Singh Ji created the Khalsa and that concept of Raj Karega Khalsa. We don't live it. If as individual Sikhs we lived it, why Guru Gobind Singh Ji created the Khalsa and we truly believed in it and believed in that concept of Raj Karega Khalsa, that you know, the natural extension, you know, trying to explain to somebody Khalistan, land of the Khalsa, land of the pure. And that's not to say it's a land only for the pure. It's actually saying we want a system that has all those positives from the teachings of our gurus. And so I think, and this is a bit deep, but this will keep happening to us because not enough of us believe and walk that path that the gurus taught us. And I think once, you know, we always say Maharaj apikar pakange, whether it be about Sikharaj or anything else. But ultimately, you said there's a time and a place for everything. And at the moment, you know, we're seeing when prachar happens in Punjab, whether that be around drugs, that affects people of all faith in Punjab, you know, there will be people that will say, hold on a minute, this guy's talking sense, you know, or whether that was Sanjay Nail Singh or whether it was the Nanpur Sahib resolution, that wasn't just about Sikhs. It was about greater autonomy for Punjab. So these things have a way of repeating themselves. But I think generations like us sitting here in Canada and America, Australia, a bit like the Scottish independence, you know, younger people are far more, you know, minded for an independent Scotland. And I think similarly, what we're seeing in recent times in particular is more and more people coming to realize, actually, what's wrong with having, I would say, Khalsa Raj? Because that's what the gurus taught us. There should be nothing wrong with it. And I think that's ultimately the answer. But it is a bit deep, and we all need to reflect on that.
Absolutely. I mean, Sukhbir, just quickly, is there something you want to finish on?
Yeah,
I'll let you have a finishing word.
Yeah, I'll keep it as short as I can, but I think, and it's a general point, but Jazz mentioned something, Dabindajit Bhaji mentioned something, Manveer mentioned something, and in different ways, what we're talking about is why is there a split in the sense of why is it that certain people see the kind of history of what's taken place and where we are in a particular way, and why do other people see it in another way. I think the major difference between, say, the Mughal period and the period in which we're living in now is that the Mughals did what they did, and they didn't try and hide that situation. They felt that, you know, the Sikhs and the Hindus and other non-Muslims, as far as they were concerned, were essentially pagan, and in trying to convert them, whether forcibly or not, they were actually doing a good thing. They were saving them. That's what they believed. What we have today and what we live with is a system which doesn't have actually any real true religious underpinnings. There isn't anything actually that it's based on. It's not a philosophy. It's just about control. And it's about keeping together a constructed state, which they understand is constructed. And that's where the insecurity comes from. But finally, just really quickly, we talk about numbers. And as a minority, we can often get into this kind of feeling of, gosh, you know, there's not many of us and there's so many of them. And these people think this way. Well, there was a lady called Hannah Arendt, and she was a philosopher, a writer, a poet as well, during the 1930s, and she was a Holocaust survivor, and after this period, people said, look, you know, Germany was a kind of a fairly kind of advanced, sophisticated state. How did it end up with the Nazis in power and all this stuff happening? It's almost unbelievable. How did doctors and lawyers and these people go along with such an evil regime? And she said, well, you know what, in society, she said, there's 10% of people who are merciful no matter what. There's 10% that are merciless no matter what. And then you've got 80% in the middle, and they can go either way. And that's what you have to remember, because the vast majority of people who write horrible things about Sikhs and all the rest of it are doing it on the basis of actually not knowing what they're talking about. And it's the 80% in the middle that we need to be focused on, basically educating.
That's a really interesting point. I think it's a really good point to end on as well. So I thank you all for the contribution in this discussion. The Bindajit Singh, Sukhbir Singh, thank you for joining us. And Manveer Singh, Jaz Singh, as usual, thank you again for being part of the podcast. So we'll see you and meet up again at the next podcast. So thank you again, everyone. Waheguru Ji Ka
Khalsa. Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh.
Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh.
Welcome to the Sikh Network Podcast, a weekly podcast discussing current and topical issues affecting Sikhs across the global diaspora.